This is the Adventist World Radio, and you are listening to The Voice of Hope. For more information, please feel free to write to us. Our email address is bible@awr.org, or you could also call us on WhatsApp at +1 224 222 0777.
Hello and welcome to WaveScan, the international DX program from Adventist World Radio. Researched and written in Indianapolis by Dr. Adrian Peterson and in Los Angeles by Ray Robinson. And produced in the studios of WRMI Shortwave in Okeechobee, Florida. I'm Jeff White. This is edition NWS 794 for release on Sunday, May 12th, 2024. On WaveScan today, The Zenith Radio Story, Part 3. We'll continue hearing from Valfharant in Vienna and our Philippine DX report. Here in WaveScan, we've been serializing the history of the Zenith Radio Corporation, based largely on a brochure issued by the company in 1955. Today we reach Part 3, which picks up the story from 1925. Here's Ray Robinson.
Thanks, Jeff. In 1925, in the United States, one man had sole control of radio, with the Secretary of Commerce being the supreme czar. E. F. McDonald Jr., whose financial backing and initiative had powered the growth of the company in the early 1920s, said to then-Secretary Herbert Hoover that he didn't believe the law was sound. On the invitation of Mr. Hoover, who said he'd welcome a test case, McDonald violated a Department of Commerce order and broadcast on a Canadian wavelength. The department brought an action against Zenith and against McDonald personally. Zenith went into court with the contention that the radio law of 1912 was out of date in 1926, and Zenith won. Congress then passed a law establishing the Federal Radio Commission, now the FCC, whose task it was to minimize the growing interference between stations on the same wavelength. Zenith officials took a leading part in helping to frame and pass the new law. In 1926 came one of the most important milestones in radio set history, another Zenith first. Up to that time, home radios operated on heavy storage batteries called accumulators, dry batteries, or a combination of both. Zenith developed and put on the market the first home receiver that operated directly from regular AC electric current. For most homes, this meant the end of cumbersome and messy batteries and made radio safe for the living room rug. That marked the transition of radio from tinkerer's toy to a standard household necessity. Another Zenith first of 1926 turned out to be the better mousetrap that the world didn't beat a path to. It was the first railroad train in the world equipped with shortwave radio communications, actually on 70 metres. It was a New York Central special of 12 cars that pulled out of Elkhart, Indiana on June the 11th and made the 100-mile run to Englewood, Illinois, with all communications between cab and caboose conducted by radio. The equipment was designed and installed by a then young Zenith engineer named G.E. Gustafson. He started from scratch, developing suitable antennas, signaling systems to call the crew at either end, methods of preventing road noises from getting into the mics, etc. The October 1927 issue of Proceedings of the Institute of Radio Engineers reported, quote, "No difficulty was had in maintaining two-way conversation between the caboose and the locomotive when standing still or when running at top speed. The engineer was able to hear and understand everything coming from the loudspeaker behind his head without diverting his attention from the road ahead. All train orders were given by means of the radio installation. The train was stopped and the engine uncoupled from the train and run ahead under orders given entirely by radio from the caboose. Communication was maintained with loudspeaker operation at both ends up to a distance of 4 miles," unquote. There was an official demonstration on July the 8th with a 116-car freight train carrying a passenger car and caboose filled with newspaper men and radio and railroad officials. It made the run from Englewood to Elkhart with all communications between cab and caboose by radio. Results of the official test were entirely satisfactory, and radio transmission of signals saved the delays that ordinarily had occurred previously when a train man had to walk the entire length of the train. Zenith didn't go into the railroad business because the limited market didn't justify the heavy expense involved, and because of the management's conviction that Zenith's future lay in mass production of radio equipment for the public. So the idea didn't take hold straight away, partly because of the shortage of radio frequencies and partly because the idea was not vigorously promoted. But development of FM and expansion of radio into the shortwave spectrum did lead to extensive use of radio by railroads in subsequent years. All railroads now have their trains equipped with radio to communicate both between cab and the rest of the train and between the train and land stations. Before the cell phone era, some also used radio to provide links for passenger use from moving trains to the long-distance telephone network. By 1927, the radio manufacturing industry encompassed a helter-skelter of many brand names, most of which have long since disappeared, and radios had wide variation in quality and performance. Zenith, which already possessed an outstanding reputation, placed even greater emphasis on superior quality and engineering innovations and on marketing these features. The company's advertising employed such slogans as "The quality goes in before the name goes on," "Known the world over," and "World's largest manufacturer of high-grade radio." Through most of 1927, Zenith continued to be the only manufacturer producing all-electric AC sets. To this feature was added automatic push-button tuning, which enabled the user to select any of 9 stations by simply pushing the appropriate button. The company was really beginning to roll, and in the next year, Zenith moved into high gear. The company offered a line of all-electric sets, many with automatic tuning, which sold in a price range from $100 to $2,500. By 1929, company earnings broke the $1 million mark for the first time, with a thumping $1.11 million. An interesting highlight of 1929 was the production of a custom-built radio for King Alexander I of Yugoslavia. A special emissary of the king called. He said he'd been turned down by radio manufacturers in New York who thought he was pulling a gag, and he said that he wanted to purchase a special radio set for His Majesty. He came out to the factory in formal attire, with a ribbon across his chest, and placed the order. The set was housed in one of Zenith's most ornate cabinets. It included Zenith's finest longwave and shortwave chassis, plus a remote control on a 75-foot cord. The king had a wonderful time with it. At one party, he confounded his generals by switching from station to station and shortwave to longwave with the remote control. They thought it was pure magic. The king was so pleased with the set that he gave Zenith an order to supply radios for the Yugoslavian school system. The outlook for business seemed rosy in these last months of the era of wonderful nonsense. Then came the market crash of October 1929 and the depression years that followed. All business suffered severely, and the young radio industry was thrown into virtual chaos. Zenith retrenched savagely. The Michigan Avenue offices were shut fast, and all operations were consolidated in the plant at Iron Street. Product planning was re-geared to meet the times. Large sets were replaced in the line by smaller, lower-priced models, but the emphasis on quality was not relaxed. Employees, imbued with fierce pride and loyalty, tightened their belts along with management. Among Zenith's depression weapons was a new line of low-priced table model receivers introduced in 1931. These sold in great volume. Another was a 110-volt DC radio operating directly from the electric line. This model was very popular in such cities as New York and Chicago, where large areas still had direct current, particularly in business and apartment hotel districts. The economic turn for Zenith began in 1933, and in 1934 they introduced a car radio which had the tuning control on the steering column in easy reach of the driver. In subsequent years, Zenith became one of the largest suppliers of car radios to the automobile industry. One of Zenith's other recovery tools was a legacy from McDonald's voyages to the Arctic. Along the route, he'd presented radio receivers to a number of missionaries and government officials with what he believed to be an ample supply of batteries. But he'd forgotten the loneliness of the six-month-long Arctic night, when these remote spots were completely out of touch with civilization. Radio was like a new breath of life to these isolated people, bringing them news and entertainment from all over the world. As a consequence, supplies of batteries that should have served for 3 years were exhausted in less than one. McDonald did the best he could for his Arctic friends by sending them new batteries as needed. At the same time, he began wondering if there were not some other method of supplying them with dependable power. One day, while sailing a boat, it occurred to him that the one great source of power that was available almost everywhere was the wind. In 1935, with major depression problems solved, he asked Zenith engineers to find out if there was in existence a practical device for translating free power of the wind into electricity. Within 24 hours, the engineers reported back that there were two Iowa farm boys, John and Gerhard Albers, who were associated with the Wind Charger Corporation in Sioux City, which was building wind-driven generators for charging 6-volt storage batteries. They'd solved the problem of getting their generators to work in light winds by using two airfoil sections for blades on their windmill. The wind pulled these airfoils around as compared to the way wind pushed the multitude of blades on the low-speed windmills used for farm water pumps. The Albers boys had done all of their development work without the aid of wind tunnels. Instead, they mounted wind chargers on automobiles, and on calm days, the speedometer reading gave them the wind velocity. Zenith, meanwhile, had developed an efficient battery radio that operated on a single 6-volt storage battery. When used together, this radio and the wind charger unit could provide unfailing radio operation with a total power cost of about 50 cents a year. Moreover, it had enough reserve power to operate a few lights from the storage battery, a godsend to farms that had no electricity. Zenith bought control of Windcharger, which then acquired a larger factory in Sioux City and started mass production. The first order from Zenith to Windcharger called for 50,000 units. The 6-volt Windcharger was sold for $10 to purchasers of Zenith radios who wanted the power unit. It was an outstanding commercial success. Sales were counted in tens of thousands, and since each $10 Windcharger sale usually resulted in the sale of a Zenith radio, the company soon became the industry's leading supplier of farm radios. In 1937, Zenith purchased all outstanding stock to make Windcharger a wholly owned subsidiary. And there we have to leave the Zenith story once again, but we'll be back with part 4 in a few weeks' time. Back to you, Jeff.
Thanks, Ray. Next week, Ray will be remembering an iconic top 40 powerhouse of the 60s and 70s that was the number one rated station in Detroit, Michigan. CKLW, the Big 8, from just across the border in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Antu Schlenker of Radio Free Asia tells us about the station's latest QSL card design, which marks the beginning of summer and shows stalks of bamboo. This is RFA's 85th QSL design, and will be used to confirm all valid RFA reception reports from May through August 2024. RFA confirms all accurate reception reports by mailing a QSL card to the listener. They welcome reports from DXers and also from the general listening audience. Reception reports can be sent by email to qsl@rfa.org. Ray Robinson reports that Jerry Berg's website, onthishortwaves.com, is probably closing before the end of the year. Ray says it's an amazing archive and a tremendous service that Jerry has provided to the DXSWL community. It even contains scripts for Wavescan, although they stop in early 2023. Onthishortwaves.com contains a wealth of DXSWL info, including a lot of off-air shortwave recordings from almost every country on the planet. But it appears it will be closing in a few months' time, so you may want to check out the site and download anything you're interested in before it disappears completely. The site address again is onthishortwaves.com. This week we continue with Jonathan Marx's visit to DocuFunk in Vienna, Austria, where hundreds of thousands of QSL cards and documentation from radio stations around the world are stored. Jonathan, who many of you know as the host of Media Network on Radio Netherlands, made this visit in 2009 when DocuFunk's founder Wolf Harent was still alive. Here's Wolf explaining to Jonathan what he was looking at.
Over there, what you see is not as important as it looks. What you can't see is the important things. But all this is reference, be it a card from the Antarctica, from Mount Everest, be it King Hussein of Jordan's late card, or this is the King of Sikkim, who also used to be a radio amateur. If you want to learn more about that, you should consult our webpage. We have a long story about him and other ones. This is part of research. It shows that radio and communication is history. It's not just heritage. Yeah. It's heritage. Unfortunately, not really honored by UNESCO and so on. What you can't see or what doesn't mean anything for you is if you, for instance, take a look at these. This is just documents. It's just documents. Ah, by the way, have a look. United Nations radio amateur station from Jerusalem. When was it? 1957. Just one of the things that have been done. So, back to this. It's just documents. Documents that do not exist. This is a complete set collected in many, many years of the circulars of the German Amateur Radio Society between 1933 and 1945, a Third Reich. And it all was burned down and destroyed when the headquarters was destroyed by air bombs. For many of them, it was a happy thing because their past was burning as well. We keep these files, and they are the only ones existing up to today, and they are 90% complete. We know that there was an amateur radio station in Hitler's headquarters until March 45.
And this was somebody who was it set up for political reasons, or was it simply?
It was communication, but the only communication that was remaining when the Second World War broke out, and Hitler claimed that Polish people raided a German broadcasting station. It was, in fact, a group of Germans. And one of them was a radio amateur. And the first ones to work underground, clandestine, were amateurs. Let me show you something else. We were talking about, I hope I can find it. I wasn't really expecting. Yeah, there you are, expecting you. We talked about all those documents of the Third Reich being burned. Now, this is a unique document of the German Democratic Republic. When they started to allow, we're talking about amateur radio again instead of broadcasting, when they started to allow amateur radio again, they needed strong anti-fascists to build this new organization. This is the first page. It's a unique document. Nobody knew that it was still existing. The first page of the list of those who were invited or allowed. Now, if we would go over to our files over there, radio before Germany before 45, you would find many of those names being Nazi representatives being members of the Nazi Party, being functionaries of the Nazi Party, they could believe that everything was destroyed. This is part of history. Yes, it's heritage.
So what happened then? They simply switched sides, or
no? I do not blame them. In 1945, they found themselves in East Germany. Okay. They had been radio amateurs before. They wanted to be radio amateurs again. When amateur radio was allowed again, they were asked or volunteered, and they could be more or less sure that their past was not known. And in between them, they, of course, kept silent. Yeah. I do not blame them. I don't know what I would have done if I had been at that time in that position. I just state the fact that we can reconstruct the development of these years and trace these people. Not more than that, but that's part of research. And this is part of, political history. 20 years later, when the GDR collapsed and became part of the German Federal Republic, it was the same people, the same churches, the same civil servants, the same doctors, the same ordinary people on the street, the party members, the fellow travelers, the persecuted, the same thing.
That was Wolf Harent of DocuFunk and formerly of Radio Austria International, showing Jonathan Marks around the DocuFunk facility in Vienna, Austria. This interview is from Jonathan's media network Vintage Vault, which is available online. Let's go now to Henry Umatai in the Philippines.
Hello, everyone, to the dear shortwave business, wherever you're welcome to the May 12th edition of the Philippine DX. This is report number 206. I'm Henry Umatai in Bacolod City, Negros Occidental, Central Philippines. Glad to be back, and thank you for listening. I would like to thank the following DXers for sending a reception report. Most recently, Mr. Richard Lemke in Alberta, Canada, Mr. Toshiki Moro in Tokyo, Japan, Mr. Chan Zachary Alvarez in Cavite here in the Philippines, and Mr. Marco Lasatin in San Fernando, Pampanga here also in the Philippines. To all of you, thank you very much. Reception lags for April 2024, April 9, NHK Radio Japan on 17810 in Japanese from Yamata, 0312. SAO 44 for April 9, Transworld Radio KTWR on 11965 in English from Mariso, Guam at 1120 SAO 333. April 9, Radio Thailand World Service on 9385 in English from Odontani at 1209 SAO 555. April 10, Adventist World Radio on 12040 in Indonesian from Trincomalee at 2212 SAO 333. April 10, Radio New Zealand International on 13690 in English from Rangitaki at 0803 SAO 433. And April 14, Adventist World Radio on 15430 in Chanjian from Agat, Guam at 1251 SAO 444. Some reception information sent by our DXR friend Marco Lasatin from Pampanga here in the Philippines. He heard the following stations from his location. April 15, Adventist World Radio on 11800 in Arabic from now in Germany at 1919 SIO 333. April 24, Adventist World Radio on 17565 in Ordo from Oschbronn, Austria at 1609 SIO 444. April 26, Adventist World Radio on 11850 in Burmese from Tashkent, Uzbekistan at 1444 SIO 222. And April 30, Voice of America on 17490 in Tibetan from Biblis, Germany at 1455 SIO 444. Send us your comments, suggestions, reception lags, and informations to PilipinasDX@gmail.com. That's PILIPINASDX for PilipinasDX@gmail.com. This has been Henry Umatai for Wavescan in Bacolod City, Negros Occidental, Central Philippines, saying mabuhay at maraming salamat po.
Thank you, Henry. Our editor, Adrian Peterson in Indianapolis, has passed on to us a message from Wavescan listener Helmut Matt in Herbolzheim, Germany, who says, "Today I have a little gift for you. I think I told you that I often write prose and poetry. I also wrote a poem about radio. I translated it from German to English. Of Of course, I can't translate the rhymes, but hopefully the sense of it. So here it is. I hope you like it. It's called My Radio. A radio in Dad's room. That was my best childhood dream. I didn't ask for permission and soon went hunting for waves. There wasn't much going on FM. Instead, AM was big. Whether Moscow or the GDR, there was a lot of wave riding. The radio was soon too small. A world receiver would be nice. I tuned without rest. Soon the whole world was my guest. There was Cold War on the airwaves. In jammers, they saw victory. Almost every country could be heard. Even jamming could hardly disturb us. The border wall fell. The turning point came, and radio came to an end. The danger seemed to be over. They wanted to save money now. So the stations were closed down. People saw the light on the internet. And there was no stopping the world to switch off all the stations. But broadcasting will always exist. People will keep it alive. You hear very small stations today with enthusiasm and joy. There's still a lot to listen to. There's almost no jamming to disturb us. Now you can hear many free stations because they now enliven the airwaves. You can block the internet, neutralize what you don't want. Waves that move freely, you can't put them in chains. That's how you keep the sensors down, stop shutting down the stations. That's why radio will live on. There will always be listeners. Our thanks to Helmut Mott in Herbolzheim, Germany, for his poem about radio. And we end WaveScan today with a German folk music medley by Sonja Mittlin. Thanks for listening to WaveScan, the international DX program from Adventist World Radio. Researched and written in Indianapolis by Adrian Peterson and in Los Angeles by Ray Robinson. Next week, CKLW, The Big Eight, and our Bangladesh DX report. WaveScan is heard weekly on KSDA in Guam, AWR relays in various locations, WRMI in Florida, WWCR in Tennessee, Voice of Hope Africa in Zambia, and IRRS Italy. Send reception reports directly to the station you're listening to. Reports for KSDA and other AWR sites should go to qsl@awr.org. Other correspondence, not reception reports, can be sent to wavescan@yahoo.com. I'm Jeff White at WRMI Shortwave in Okeechobee, Florida. Till next week, good listening, everyone.
This is the Adventist World Radio, and you are listening to The Voice of Hope. For more information, please feel free to write to us. Our email address is bible@awr.org, or you could also call us on WhatsApp at +1 224 222 0777.